Now what's going on is that I'm really not sure if this is my camera, my cell phone, or my PDA. It's kind of all three. It's actually my modem for my computer, too. So we have devices converging, so we don't have specialized devices anymore. So it's getting a little confusing to figure out what a computer is. I mean, how many computers do you think I have that are right now on my body? Two, right? Okay. And then there's a computer there, there's a computer around there. We've got computers everywhere, right? The computers in every digital clock. So computers are sort of receding, and what is coming to the fore is the purpose, is the content. So the network is sort of receding. Right? And now we're thinking about, well, what kind of content is out there and what kind of devices is that exposed to this content.
Make sense how we got here?
So that's just a little bit of content. That's not something on the exam. Here's what's going to be on the exam. When you push that button, what happens? It sends a computer through this wire to the computer.
Signal.
Yeah, and what happens to that signal?
Computers
repeat,
then takes different
reactions. The computer. So what part is the computer? Something inside there takes the signal and then figures out what to do, and then draws something on the screen that has some meaning to you. It doesn't really have any meaning to the computer. It's just programmed to draw that on the screen. So for example, if you move the mouse a little bit, the computer says, ah, a sensor detected the mouse moved this far in that direction. So I should draw a screen that has something on it moved in that direction some distance. Not actually the same distance. Because the screen might be bigger or smaller. So it's interpreting it in some sense, but it doesn't, nothing has meaning to it. Okay, so the input comes from somewhere, the output goes to somewhere, and the system does something with it, and this is where we're going to have fun today. What's that system do? What is that? Okay. So here's the basic idea. The network's going to be for next week. We've got all this input-output thing. There's a processor and memory. The computer is really stupid. I mean, it's really stupid. It can't remember anything for very long. So it puts it into memory, which is like an elephant, remembers everything perfectly forever, and then pulls it back when it needs it. The computer is like a child with a limited attention span. It doesn't have any context to how it got here. It's got a program that says, go get this from memory, go get that from memory, look at them, decide what to write to memory, write. Now that's the thing you can get from memory, go get it, get something else, look at them, decide what to do with it, write something out to memory. Now that's something you can get, that's something you get, let's go get those. So it's always looking at one thing or at two things, deciding what to do and writing it to memory. The computer and memory are inextricably linked. It can't do anything over a long term without storing things in memory. How does it know which kind of comparison to do? The program. What's the program? Where does it get the program? From memory. Right. So if the computer's got the ability to read in the instruction, then to go get the first piece of data, go get the second piece of data, compute the result, and write it out, and it can't do anything else. Everything you do with a computer, you have to break down into very, very small steps that are that small. Okay, so this connection between processor and memory is key. So here's a picture of a data flow in a computer. Now this is a picture of a kind only an engineer could draw, right? Because A box now is a thing, it does some kind of processing, it has some purpose, and an arrow is a connection. And so, here's what happens. The computer has got some memory, which, for a very bizarre reason, is called L1. So computer people are not necessarily too good at explaining this stuff. So everything I was just telling you about is between the computer and L1. Now, it turns out that L1 is really teensy. There might be, 128,000 different places you can put things in there, which in the computer world is really teensy. But L1 is really fast. So while the computer is here running, however fast it can do things, L1 is just that fast. Right? So the computer can get things in and out of L1 really quickly. Anybody want to guess how quickly? How long does it take the computer to...
What's a nanosecond, and then I'll have a better idea what half of one would be.
I can't remember the exact ratio to the second, but...
It's shorter than a second?
I believe it is.
A lot shorter?
Yeah.
A billion? Okay. That's a national debt, right? $1 trillion! And I'm like, I've seen $1 trillion. How high would it be if you stacked up $1 trillion? So, let's try to get some idea what a nanosecond is. What's the fastest thing you can perceive? How short a thing could happen and you could actually tell? Human perception time. Anybody? What's that? The blink of an eye. How long does your eye take to blink? The book actually has pictures. Yep. How long does it take to blink an eye?
I think it was 1,000 nanoseconds. It
was
that way. It was
something silly. Less than a second. A tenth of a second. That means you can only blink your eyes 10 times in a second. Right. Yeah? I mean, it's hard to blink your eyes 10 times a second. That's about right. Yeah. So, the blink of an eye, human perception time, is a tenth of a second. Now, if we made up a name for everything for a tenth of a second, we called it a decisecond. It'd be really amusing, right? A hundredth of a second would be a centisecond. Right? A thousandth of a second would be a millisecond. We actually use that one. That's a thousandth. 100 milliseconds in the blink of an eye. Thousandth of a second, there are 100 of those in the tenth of a second it takes you to blink your eyes. Now, if we go to 1,000th of a second, then what do we get? We get a microsecond. 1,000th of a millionth of a second. And there are 100,000 of them. In the blink of an eye. If the computer does things in a nanosecond, that's 1,000th of a microsecond. There are 100 million of those in the blink of an eye. So all these things I'm telling you about, that you know, I gotta name this, name that, it does 100 million of them. And that's how it looks like it's doing it. It's just really fast. Now, is it clear now why if L1 is slow, it does not matter what speed the CPU runs at? L1 must run at the CPU speed, otherwise the CPU has to slow down for it. But if I make memory fast, it is very expensive per bit, per chunk of memory. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a little bit of memory fast. Now, what happens if what I'm looking for isn't in L1 because L1's full? Well, then I need to go up to the attic and get it, right? I have some slower memory, more of it, that I didn't pay as much for per bit, but I got a lot more because I've lost slower memory. Yes? It's just like keeping things in the attic. Once a year, up to the attic you go, you bring it all down, takes a little while, but now you've got it all handy. So that's what happens. We go up to the attic, which is L2, we get what we need, and we bring it down here to L1, and then it's really bad. Now, where does the stuff that was in L1 go when we do that? Up to the attic, right? Okay, so you just swap things between L1 and L2, and every time you get to the point where you have to do that swap, your computer slows down. How much does it slow down? Well, L2 is slower than L1, but what's really slow is RAM. This takes 6 nanoseconds. So this is like, you know, like over to the storage depot, right? You know, I go rent a room someplace else and put my junk in it. Right? 6 nanoseconds. I mean, we send a truck over here to get the darn thing. Okay, so if we can't find it in L1, we look in L2. If we can't find it in L2, we look in RAM. Are you going to notice? Depends on how many things your computer's doing at once and how complicated they are. If it's doing some fancy game controller thing with lots of graphics, 3D space things, you might notice. It might start to look jerky. If it has to go over into RAM a lot, in which case, you should have paid more and gotten a bigger L2. So this is called cache. It's a temporary place to put things. And this is level 1 cache, and this is level 2. And if that doesn't work, we go look in RAM. In practice, what we do is we simply say where we want to find something in RAM. That's what the CPU does. And whatever part of RAM is being held in L1 right now, the cache knows. It looks in L1 to see if that part of RAM is there. And if so, it pulls in. So the CPU doesn't have to keep track of any of this. L1 knows what it's got in it. And it goes and gets things from L2 when it needs them. And L2 knows what it's got. And it goes and gets things from RAM when it needs them. And if you have anything that's been changed, it's referred to as dirty. It's got a dirty bit set, and it gets written back in the event of a change. Otherwise, if somebody says, it just vaporizes. If I read it in, didn't change it, next time I read it, I'll get the same thing. Clear what's going on? Okay, so now, here's what we do for the next trick. Anybody know how a hard drive works? Tell me the story.
It works like a record player.
Works like a record player. So it spins, right? It's got one groove, goes all the way in. No, okay, not quite like a record player. Yeah, okay, so a hard drive is a platter, and unlike a record player, which would have a single groove that goes all the way in, you put the needle in and plays the record, what it has is it has one head that moves in and out, and then since it's spinning, you can just wait. Let's say the thing you're looking for is here. You see how it's got a little lines drawn? There aren't real lines drawn on the real thing, but it's showing you that here's a chunk, there's a chunk, there's a chunk. These things are called a sector on the disk, and this circular thing is called a track. And so this sector, if I want to read it here, I move this head over to the track, wait for this to come around, which might be very fast if it was very close, or maybe very long if it was very close, but by the time the head gets here, it's just passed. I got to wait for it to go around again. So how fast do these things go around? Nobody knows.
Somewhere about 5,400 RPM.
5,400 revolutions per minute. Every minute. It goes around 5,400 times if it's a slow one, 7,000 some odd times if it's a fast one. Not much faster, right? So how long does it take for me to get the head moved? Now this head is mechanical, right? To actually move it. When my hard drive breaks, it's because some mechanical piece is broken more often than not. So this head has to move out, then I have to wait for the thing to come around. 5,400 sounds like a big number until we divide it by 60 and find out how many revolutions is that per second. Right, if it was 6,000, it would be 100. so it's a little less than 100 revolutions per second. So I have to wait like more than a hundredth of a second for this thing to happen. In fact, on average, with a 5400 RPM disk, I have to wait a tenth of a second. You remember the blink of an eye? The blink of an eye is how long? Tenth of a second. That's going to be a magic number all semester. That's what you care about. If you beat a tenth of a second, it looks like magic. If you're slower than a tenth of a second, it's discernibly slow. Right? And it will turn out that there are some things that computers cannot do in less than a tenth of a second. And knowing which things they are important. Okay, now. What is the thing I'm looking for I can't find in RAM? Because I didn't buy enough RAM. I only bought 512 megabytes of RAM because that's what came with my machine, right? Where do I store things if I'm running lots of programs at the same time and I need more storage? What's that? Somebody said it? The hard drive, right? Okay, great. So anybody remember how fast this is? 6 nanoseconds. This one? 10 milliseconds, right?
Yes.
Like an eye. Okay. 10 milliseconds, 6 nanoseconds. Let's round it off and call it 10 nanoseconds, just so that we're able to compare our nanoseconds to our milliseconds, okay? We'll be off by a factor of 2, but that's okay. How much difference is there between here and here? What factor? Is it a factor of 10? Factor of 1,000. Okay, so I start with my second, tenth of a second, hundredth of a second, thousandth of a second. We call that a millisecond. Millionth of a second, we call it a microsecond. That's the one I didn't talk about very much. Billionth of a second, we talk about a nanosecond. 10 milliseconds to 10 microseconds, that would be a factor of 1,000. 10 microseconds down to 10 nanoseconds, that would be a factor of 1,000. I got 2 1,000 factors. That's a factor of 1,000,000. With me? Okay. This is 1,000,000 times slower than this. Now, to get from this down to this, what factor do I have? I said I could do 2 in a nanosecond, right? Somebody over here said I could do 2 in a nanosecond. 2 operations every nanosecond, half a nanosecond. This is 6 nanoseconds. This is about 0.6 nanoseconds, right? Give or take. This is about a factor of 10. A factor of 10 to go from the L1 through the L2 to the RAM, it slows me down by a factor of 10. Whatever, I paid for a fast computer, but I didn't get enough L1 and L2 cash, I may as well have bought a slow computer. Maybe 10 times as slow. Yes? Worst case. If I didn't buy enough RAM, and I have to go out here, how much slower do I get? 1,000,000. Now, have any of you ever gone to a computer shop and said, my computer is too slow, I need a faster computer, and they said to you, buy more RAM, and you said, I want a faster computer, what do I need more memory for, right? It's not forgetting anything. Yes? Clear now? What's that? But it makes sense now, yes?
Yeah.
The problem is that you can't store all the information for the programs you have running in the RAM you have. So what does the computer do? Naturally, it uses the next thing it has in RAM, because it's got this cascade of addicts after addicts after addicts. Right? How can you tell if your computer is doing this? Well, often, because the hard drive is mechanical, it makes a noise. Sometimes it's like a light when the hard drive is kind of going at it. does on my laptop. So if you're looking at this thing and the light's on all the time, or you're hearing the computer, it's going, that's what it's doing. It's in here reading and writing stuff, trying to get over to that other program, and your computer's just sitting there with the screen replacing about this rate. Right? Slower than a tenth of a second. Your eye can see it. Okay. So, you've got the idea now what the CPU is, what the cache is, what the RAM is, what the hard drive is. Now, of course, that's only a part of the hard drive. That's the sort of overflow of the RAM. You can also store things on the hard drive. And when you refer to things in the computer, you normally refer to pieces of the hard drive. Right? You normally say, this file name on my hard drive. And it simply copies it into the RAM, that the RAM needs a little overflow. It just goes and uses some hard drive. That technique is called virtual memory. Okay, let's see what we skipped. So the hardware for the computer is the central processing unit. You can get all sorts of different RAMs. Pretty much everything these days is either made by Intel or somebody copying Intel's architecture. That's just some way of getting stuff back and forth. So all those wires I showed you that were connecting things, those are called a bus. Now, why would you call them a wire? Well, because they have multiple wires going at the same time so that we can send the signal faster by sending many parts of the signal. All those ones and zeros, we send a whole chunk of them at once, clock them into the memory, send a whole another chunk. So you can get a 8-wide bus in an old computer, 16-wide bus, 32 bits wide, 64 bits wide. Right? That's just the amount you can send over. So it's more than one wire. And often it will have an address to say where it's going, because when you plug things into the computer, you just get some RAM and plug it into the bus. You don't plug it into the L2 or the L1 or the CPU. You just plug it into the bus, plug this into the bus. Whenever this needs to talk to that, it just says, hey, RAM, listen up. Here's what I want to do. Right? Put it here. And it goes and tells it where to put it, and then puts it there. Right? So there's no specific part of this that's connected to a specific part of that. Same thing here. If I want to talk to my video card to draw something on the screen, the CPU says, hey, video card, listen up, and says what it has to say. Now, because when it talks to the RAM, it has to talk very fast. It has a special purpose, very fast bus. And then if nobody answers on that very fast bus, it just passes it up to the system bus, which is slower, and waits for the video card to answer up. Okay? Okay, so that's what the buses are about. We get lots of kinds of buses. We've talked about cache, RAM, and hard drive. We'll talk about more kinds of storage. And then there are ways that you can communicate off of the computer, which we'll talk about next time. For now. Now, if I want to send something someplace, let's say that I want to send a bunch of files to somebody in California. We actually used to do this. What I could do is I could go out and I could buy a hard drive, put the files on the hard drive, just stamp out, put the stamp on the hard drive, and mail the hard drive to California. Now, you would say, if I did that, that's a very slow way to get files to California, right? How fast are the files going to California? About 500 miles an hour in the airplane, right? How fast do files go if I send them over the internet? At the speed of light. So, which will get my files to California faster? Speed of light, probably going to win this one, right? So think about this one carefully. Let's say that I had a dial-up modem. You know, back in the old days, anybody ever had how fast could I put bits into the dial-up modem? What rate would it take the bits in at? Sort of a thin pipe, right? Anybody remember?
I remember when it, I was so excited that 56K came out.
56K, yeah. It turns out there's a theoretical limit that keeps you from sending more than 56K down phone lines in the United States. Now, 56K what? What's a K anyway? Kilo. Kilo is a
1,000
related to milli. Milli was also 1,000, wasn't it?
1,000.
Milli was 1,000 in the other direction. This is a kilo in the... It's actually not 1,000. Very close, 1,024. Why 1,024? What's that?
The power of two.
The power of two. We got all these zeros and ones, so twos are like the very power base twos, very powerful. All right, so I have, it's right at home, it doesn't make sense here. Let's say I have the number one, and I multiply it by two, then what number do I have? Two. Then I multiply that by two, what do I get?
Four.
Multiply that by two?
Eight.
Multiply that by two?
16.
Hey, keep track of how many times we're doing this. Multiply that by 2. 32. It's harder when you're trying to do them both at once, right? 32. Multiply that by 2.
54.
Keep going.
1024.
How many of those did you have to do?
10.
2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 10 times, which we call 2 to the 10th power, is 1,024. It's very close to 1,000, so it's very handy to think of 1,024 as 1,000. In fact, I can make a list for you. So, 2 to the 10th is 1,024, 2 to the 20th is 1,024 times 1,024, which is that number. So we call that a mega. And then gigabyte is 2 to the 30. Terabyte, so I just saw you can buy a terabyte disk drive for $50. So a terabyte is that much for $50 now. And a petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. Those are atomic pieces, but I say, and that's real relevant. So these are all counted on bytes. And bytes are kind of funny things because bytes are 8 bits. So a bit is the 1 or 0. And then 8 bits is, we refer to it as a byte, it's enough to store a character in. What do I mean by enough to store a character in? If I have 8 bits, I can represent how many different numbers? What's that? No, if I have 1 bit, I can represent 0 or 1, 2 different possibilities. If I have 2 bits, I can represent 0, 1, 2, or 3. 0, 0, 0, 1. 1011, four possibilities. Remember how that works? 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, right? If I have 8 bits, I can represent 256 possibilities, which is conveniently larger than the number of letters in the English language. Even counting uppercase and lowercase and digits and all the funny things you might want to write. I really need 7 bits. But geeks just love things that are multiples of 2, so they raised it a bit and went to 8 bits. Okay? So, we call that a byte. Do you know what you call 4 bits, by the way? Nobody? What's that? $1. This is a quarter. Okay. But what do you call 4 of these kinds of bits? This is just as geeky. It's called a nibble.
Half
a byte. Okay. Alrighty, and then again, W. So, now, when we could do 56 kilobits per second, that's how we got started on this, right? 56,000 bits per second, not quite because of the 1024 business, right? That's bits, not bytes. So we have to divide it by 8. Right? So we're only going to get in bytes, the characters sent to the other side, whatever 56 divided by 8 is. What's that? 7 kilobytes? Yeah, that'll work. So I get 7,000 bytes sent per hour. Okay, now here's the problem. We were trying to send 200 terabytes. Is the terabyte there? Okay. Now we were able to send 7 kilobytes. And so how many hours would it take us to send it at the speed of light to California? Well, that's 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000. So, in 1,000,000,000 seconds, We could have sent this at the speed of light to California. So no, it doesn't really feel like the speed of light anymore, right? It's much faster to simply take the big disk and stick it on an airplane and fly it there at 500 miles an hour, and when it's there, plug it in. Do you see it? Two speeds. There's the speed of the first bit getting there. Sure enough, that's the speed of light. Right? So California is an 80th of a second away at the speed of light. So you'll work out the 186,000 miles per second and the 2,100 miles. An 80th of a second to California for the first bit. How long does the second bit take to get there? Well, in this case, the second byte. Well, it's the time for the first bit plus the delay between the first bit and the second bit, right? Yes? So if I make that delay too long, I'd do better to ship my hard drive. If that delay is real short, fine, then I can send it. So we refer to this as the speed of my modem. The modem isn't moving. The bits aren't moving. Right? The modem's just sitting here. It's really the throughput of my modem, the rate at which it will pass things through. Yes? So we call that the bandwidth. So there are always two times that we have to think about. There's the amount of time it takes the data to travel from here to there, and then the amount of data you can stuff into one end of the pipe in a fixed amount of time. That typing that you're doing there, what kind of bandwidth do I need to move that typing into the computer? Well, how many keys do you press every second? Sixty words a minute. How many keys in a word? What's that? Yeah, six on average in English, right? You would have thought five. Five's the published number, but there's a space. So six characters get hit every second if you're typing 60 words a minute. That's 6 bytes. Characters a byte. Every second. How many could we do with our modem? 7,000 every second, right? So the bandwidth of what you're doing is perfectly fine through any speed modem you can get at all. Right? Doesn't matter how fast your modem is if what you're trying to do is type that. Okay? Now, what if I have an image I took with my digital camera. Anybody have a digital camera and look at how big the images are? So how big is an image in your digital camera?
Depending on what setting I use, 1024 by 728, sometimes bigger than that.
No, but how many kilobytes or megabytes or petabytes or millibytes?
Oftentimes about
Kilobytes. 80 kilobytes. I can send 7 kilobytes per second. How many seconds?
More than 10.
11 and a half seconds to send a picture through this old slow modem, but typing, not a problem. So if what you type is, please send me a picture, you get the message to them really quickly. The instant you hit the last character, it's there. So on the web, clicking on things, that's like just pushing the button, right? Just sends a few characters to the other side. Very fast. Sending the picture back, very slow if you're on a limited bandwidth. So the case of viewing a picture, bandwidth bothers you. The case of typing something, bandwidth doesn't bother you. But now if I'm in a chat room and I'm typing something to somebody and they're typing back an answer, if I have a latency of 5 seconds, am I going to be bothered? Yeah, maybe not much though, right? Because it might take 5 seconds to think of what to say. So the computer is working at about the speed of their brain. Right? What about a telephone call with them? And there's a 5-second latency.
That's creepy.
Yeah, can you actually learn to live with a 5-second latency? The one that's really hard for people is a 1/4 second. Because remember what human perception time is? Blink of an eye, right? If I add a 1/4 second latency, it screws up all your interruption timing. So you end up interrupting them just after they started saying something. Because we have social conventions where we leave little breaks for interruptions, and when they don't get taken, we go on. And that quarter second just, you can never quite explain why, but it just feels all screwed up. So they did studies of this, phone company, to see, what was the worst latency. And then they built the communication satellites. And they put the communication satellites up in a very high orbit, over, it's 100,000 miles or something. No, I can't remember. 24,000 miles. Anyway, it turns out it's exactly 1/4 second. Right. Just as bad as it could possibly be. And that's why most of the international traffic now goes by undersea cable. Because California is an 80th of a second away. 80th of a second doesn't bother you at all. But for telephone, 1/4 second, which is satellite delay, is just terrible. Okay, so the tone transfer time to count, that's the first bit plus the time between the first and last bit. For long distances, that first bit time is important, like with the satellite, right? Where it's 1/4 of a second. Less of a problem with the speed of light as long as you hug the Earth. And then for large files, the bits per second dominates. So the claim here is inside the computer, it's the bandwidth that counts, not the travel time. Why? What's that? Because it's not traveling very far. Everything inside that case is the speed of light is real close. Now, how many of you have heard of Moore's Law? What does Moore's Law say? Depends on which year you ask more, apparently.
The speed of the computer doubles every...
Once in a while. Yeah. It's just computers are always getting faster. How many things do you know that are getting cheaper? Oil? Okay, so computers are getting faster. Why are computers getting faster? Because the transistors inside the computer are getting closer together. Which means, at the speed of light, it takes less time to get from one transistor to the other. So, inside computers, what we care about when we get out to the bus is the bandwidth, the bits per second. Now, I made you a promise. I told you that you were going to change what you thought of as space, time, and speed. Did I succeed? Yes, no? Then you can take a break. Back in 10 minutes? How are you?
Well, what happened?
No, I don't think
so.
Okay, Rebecca is abandoning us. So if you have any questions for her, your next chance is on Saturday or by email, right? The entire class is very email intensive. Expect you to engage with this stuff on a regular basis. Thank you for coming. Okay, a couple things about breaks. There has been a study done that showed that students who sit down for the entire break are more likely to fall asleep sometime during the remainder of the class than students who stand up during the break, and that there's a further benefit to stepping outside that door. Right? Not necessarily all the way outside, it's cold. But if you do that, that's a good thing to do during each break. So we'll have calisthenics out in the hallway on the next break to encourage you. But now, second thing is, there's a tremendous tendency to check your email while you're sitting here. So I know that because whenever I sit there, I check my email. Okay? So there's a really cool gizmo up here that has the ability to pick up any screen from any computer in here and display it on the front. And one of my colleagues, I won't say who, will routinely wander up, randomly punch a button, and continue the class. So I would never think to do that. But I would just suggest to you that it is awfully seductive when we put the technology in front of you to use the technology for a purpose different from what it's intended for. So the question is, what's it intended for? Well, it's intended to create an immersion learning environment. You came to study technology, and we will live inside the beast. We are surrounded by it up here, here. We'll use it for many different things over the course of the semester, and it's just a natural part of what we do. Right? So that's the goal. So it's actually good if you check your email, just not during class. Okay, now let me start the second part here by asking for questions. I ask you, as you did your reading, to think about where you had questions as you engaged in the material. And then I just went through a grand tour of computing from one particular perspective. Maybe a perspective you had thought about and had questions about and have answered them, but quite likely you came at it from a different perspective. Or maybe I just took you through a perspective you hadn't thought of before, and you've got questions about that. So this is your class, not my class. I already know quite a lot of this. I actually don't know it all. I learn as we go. I learn from you sometimes. But this is the class you're paying for, either with your money, or, even more importantly, with your time and attention, or both. And so I'm serious about you taking control over what you want to learn. Questions?
I have a question about CDs versus DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
I said that CDs save, like, JPEG images. Images as JPEG. And it didn't explain whether or not if they were, say, TIFF originally or RAW, did they convert them into JPEG? Because the DVDs, they said, save them at higher resolution. So it seemed like they were setting it up that if you're saving something to a CD, it's going to compress the image. Mm-hmm. Where that would not be the case with DVDs.
Okay, so this is a really good question because it sort of threads across many of the things that we deal with this semester. First, the only thing that's happening is that hits are getting actually made on the plastic surface and being read with a laser beam. And the lack of a pit or the presence of a pit are a one or a zero. Actually, don't know which, but that's how the ones and zeros are encoded is with these pits. And the pits are rotating, the laser beam's pointing different places, and it's just reading off sequences of ones and zeros. identical for a DVD and a CD, except for a DVD, the hits are closer together and smaller, right? So it's a more finely tuned laser beam. There's nothing else going on. So anything that you're asking about here would be in the mind of the programmer who decided on how to use the CD or the DVD. Now, the second thing to say is that CDs and DVDs are like records. They're literally like records in that they have a single track that goes all the way out, unlike the magnetic media, the hard drive that we looked at, that had concentric tracks. It's got a single spiral track. Strangely, they go from inside to outside, unlike LPs. So the design of that, the purpose of that, is to play streaming media, not to hold a file. It's somebody else who came along later and said, hey, these are just ones and zeros. We could store files here. But all they're doing is just keeping a sequence of bits that they could use to recreate a signal in the CD audio format, if it's a CD, or in the NTSC video format, if it's DVD. And that's what it was designed for in the first place. Now, if I get a DVD drive, I can put a DVD in it, and I could read off ones and zeros, and if somebody else wrote onto it ones and zeros for a JPEG or a TIFF or anything else, things we'll talk about later in the semester, image format, it'll work just fine. So in fact, I have a DVD player at home, not a computer, but of course, DVD players have computers inside them, and I can put in a DVD that has a lot of JPEGs on it, it'll play it perfectly fine. Then just look, it's got a little image browser. If I put in a CD that's got JPEGs on it, it'll play it perfectly fine. So if the book was leading you to an impression that the storage medium had something to do with what you could store on it, no, they're just ways of storing ones and zeros. And you can put anything on you want.
Okay, so by having a higher resolution, it's much, there's more storage.
There's more room. So you could put a high, you could choose to put a higher resolution image on it. Yeah, if I take all the photographs I've ever taken with a digital camera and try to put them on a CD, I'll run out of space. But I won't run out of space as quickly in the DVD. Other questions? Yeah.
Based off of reading in the chapter 7, I don't understand why there's such a big deal between the Blu-ray disc and the HD DVD. That's, I don't understand why some companies want to highlight one. The Blu-ray disc compared to the HD one, but I just don't understand that, and I couldn't get an understanding from the reading on if one is quicker than the other, or if one is currently has the edge over the other.
Right, okay. So this is a really interesting question that is much more about the adoption of new technologies than it is about the characteristics of the technology. At any given point in time, it's possible to make technologies with certain technical characteristics, and then you can organize them in different ways. So for example, the Apple used to use a different processor than the PC. After a while, they found that so many of the PC's processors, which are made by Intel, were being made, that it made sense to re-engineer their Apple for the PC processor, because they could get a better price-performance ratio. But initially, that wasn't clear, so it was one of Apple's sort of competitive advantages that you weren't using the evil Intel chip, you were using the good Motorola chip, you know. There was, in the early days of videotape, VCRs, Beta versus VHS. Well, it turns out Beta was the technically superior format, but that for image quality, but the VHS had the long play version was longer than Beta's long play version by, I think, half an hour or something like that. That turned out to be what was preferred by the market, was the lower image quality. Remember, people usually have pretty cheapy TV sets anyway in that era, and the longer recording ability, because the tape costs money. And so what's going on with Blu-ray and HD DVDs is very much the same thing. They're both in the same technology generation. One of them stores slightly more information, and so they would say, oh, we'll have a better ability to add extra things to your show, you know, that would be, that's their advertising. I went to the Consumer Electronics Show 2 years ago when they were doing this, and that was the spiel they were making, was, you know, like, but, you know, what were they holding? They were holding, you know, 10% more information. So that may be the winning picture, but this is going to be won not on the computer side, but on the consumer electronics side. And the real concern that everybody has is that you just need the much higher density to get the high-definition television, which has quite a lot more complex signal. Both of them are fine. One of them will win in the marketplace, and that one will get adopted in computers. You might have, a couple of years ago, tried to buy a DVD drive, and you had to decide whether you wanted a DVD-dash drive or a DVD-plus drive.
Yeah.
That was the same thing. It turned out they were similar enough that now all the DVD drives do both, but the media is still designed one way or the other. So this is essentially a technology adoption issue rather than a core technology issue. And that's as important an issue in this class, right? So the question is there a difference in the technologies? And then if there isn't a difference in the technologies, why is there a difference in the outcomes? Mm-hmm. And it's for market dynamics reasons, much more than that.
Thank you.
Yep. Other questions? Yeah.
DISC versus DISK. I'm doing the reading, I never realized that DISK was referred to magnetic disks and DISC was referred to optical disks. So that was kind of cool to read. But my question is, why is there a difference in the spelling?
You're outside my knowledge base. I don't think either one is an acronym, right? I think that it's simply an attempt to differentiate products back in the early days of their introduction. The optical discs were a very high technology innovation that came long after magnetic discs. Magnetic discs were back from the mainframe era, and they just kept getting smaller and more robust. The optical discs have lasers in them, so there's a whole technology path that had to come along before that could work out. And so there was, when optical discs came along, there was a desire to differentiate them, is my guess. But in practice, these days, probably people get that backwards if they haven't read the book, right?
I probably would.
So here's another one for you along the same line. Do you know what the original meaning of the term computer was?
A person who sat in a room with a pencil.
That's right. It was a person who computed. And then that was appropriated to describe the machine that did the computation. And in the early days, the people who operated the machines were called computers. That was the name of the job. Right? You were hired to be a computer. Good. You were just using the machine. So we need this ability to create new meanings for words we already have. Otherwise, we'd have to be constantly making it to the end. Other questions? Okay, so here's what I'd like to do next. As I say, seriously, this is your class, and I want you to tell us what you want it to be. So here's how you're going to do that. You're going to turn to the person next to you, and you're going to introduce yourself briefly. So take a couple of minutes. And then get to know them. And then you will stand up and introduce your friend in 30 seconds. Right? And here's what I want you to say. There's something about this machine. It will now go through 45 slides. It does this to me every single time. Yep. Okay, so we didn't do it ever, right? You're up with a person you don't yet know, so if you know the person next to you, no, that's okay. Introduce yourselves to each other, and then introduce your partner to us, and this is what I want to know. Name, background, so name, like, what you really want to be called, how to build a roster. Background, it's got to be really short, it's 30 seconds, right? Your goals, and one interesting thing, which I will leave to you. Okay. Go.
George Washington University Library. We took the goals differently. I've been to goals in her career. So she would eventually like to work in an academic library. And I'm sure it applies to whatever she learns to that. And what's interesting about her is that her brother is a computer engineer, and she's also the translator between her brother and her mother. And then over to the left is Jamie, and she works for the Digital Library Federation. And she has the goal of being a school media library specialist. And she likes to play racquetball. She doesn't play very well, but she loves playing it anyway.
This is Yanni Yancey. She is from upstate New York, and she has an undergrad in speech pathology. And what are your goals? So I'm going to say, goal is to be an architect.
I don't know, as a general.
And the interesting thing about her, she goes, we don't do anything with hexadecimal.
You hope we don't do anything.
Are we not doing anything?
You can manage to avoid it as long as you do octal.
Okay. This is Emily Nisley. She's a English major from Pennsylvania. Her goal is to be able to intelligently pick out a new computer back in the class. And her interesting thing is that she's trying out for choir tonight, so wish her well.
This is Sarah. She teaches high school, and she's trilingual. Her major is French, and mine is Spanish. And she's a translator of French and Spanish. The goal is to pass the class.
This is Yejun Wu. He is a PhD candidate, and he is defending his dissertation on Friday. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ord is his advisor. His research is on monolingual and class language information retrieval systems and text classification.
So we got the right two people sitting next to each other in all these foreign languages.
Mara, she did her undergraduate in California. Her goal is to, one, learn how computers work, and two, to pass the class. And her interesting thing is that she was born in Japan.
And you've already achieved your first goal. Now you're not a computer.
This is Sarah. She did her undergrad here. Her goal is to, again, learn how computers work, become an architect. And one interesting thing is she has a titanium plate in her left leg.
This is Jason. She got an undergraduate degree in English. Her goal for the class is to learn how to use a computer effectively, and she's a beekeeper.
And this is Leah Kim. She's on the archives track in information and career. She's from Wisconsin. Her goal is to join the 21st century. And her, what interesting thing is she knows all about tea.
She's in the sharp end. You should get
together. This is Laura. She's from California. She graduated from Bryn Mawr with a BA in comparative literature. Her goal in general is to graduate from this program and to know by then what exactly her goal is. And her interesting thing is that she's going to Montreal for her spring lit.
This is Traxa, and she's from Baltimore, and she got her undergrad degree in classical civilizations and art history. And her goal is to work in a public library. And her interesting thing is that she owns over 250 pens and
This is Heidi. Heidi has a master's degree in English from University of Maryland. And she's currently at Johns Hopkins as a rare books assistant. One of her goals, besides just wanting to learn how a computer works, is to become an academic librarian. And an interesting thing about Heidi is she is into silent movies.
And this is Paul
Chasen.
For the past 3 years, I've been working on a computer
program
for the past 3 years. He has been a circulation supervisor at Bonner County Public Library branch. His background is he has a bachelor's in history from Towson University. And for this course of school is to learn more about web pages, web design. And his career goal, of course, is to become a wonderful public librarian and perhaps one day manage his own branch. And an interesting thing about him is that he used to run track and field in college.
This is Chris. He's a history major. He has 3 years of experience working in an academic library and 6 months experience working in a government library. His goal is to one day work either in a public or an academic library. And one interesting fact about him, he is at this very moment brewing his own beer.
He's
fermenting
cool.
Only speed.
That's cool. Cool.
So not an issue, the Chardonnay.
Anyway, this is Mark. He also has a history degree, but unlike me, he went back and got a master's. He currently works for a trade association working on their website. His goals are to, one, learn how to do better things with the website for this, in this class, and also one day to work in an academic or public library. And his interesting fact is he's currently teaching himself to play guitar. Says he knows 3 chords right now.
This is Anne. She's from New York City, but has been in D.C. for 6 years, working at the Washington Post as a travel writer, and asks questions as though she works at a newspaper, which is very good. She wants to become a photo archivist, and she majored in Chinese.
And this is Sarah with an H. And she's originally from Illinois, but now lives in Odenton. And she is a music librarian with the U.S. Army Field Band. She's sergeant first class. And one of her goals is to, when she graduates, is to actually qualify for the job that she already has. And she will know as of tomorrow whether or not she's still young.
Okay, I'm going to do something a little interesting here. We had 3 people and not 2, so I'm going to introduce PCC to Andrea Splendig, with the history of things up there. So this is PC. She got a degree in English from St. Mary's. She wants to work in museums, and she currently works for the Chevy Chase Historical Society. And her interesting fact is she makes a bomb risotto.
This is Linda, and she got her BS in government politics and at Maryland here. And her goals, her goal is to continue doing reference in the specialty library. And she, one interesting fact about her is that she was born and raised locally.
And this is Rachel. Her background is English, and her goal is to get involved in digital records. And the interesting thing about her, I think it's her car.
It is.
Her car, named Blue Omar.
I'm sorry?
Blue Omar.
O-R-M.
Okay. This is Diana Weiss, and she has a background as an editor with books and magazines and then at NASA. Her goal is to be a high school librarian for this particular class to learn a lot more about doing the web page. And an interesting fact about her is Diana is spelt with a Y, not with an I.
And this is Elizabeth Norton. Her background is in healthcare management, consulting, and analysis. She, for this class, would like to learn to create a functional website, and in life, would like to retire financially secure by age 65. And an interesting fact is when she was snorkeling in December in Florida, she looked down and saw a shark.
This is Dawn Sherman. She's currently a archivist in training at NARA, and her overall goal is to become a full-time true archivist at NARA. And one interesting thing about her is that she enjoys kickboxing.
And this is Amy. She has her undergraduate from Gettysburg Institute. Her goal is to create really cool websites and to work in a specialized archive. And interesting about her is that she participates in Civil War reenactment.
Thank you all. Nice job. I was taking notes on some of the things that you were talking about because I think they're important for the class. So one of the obvious ones is we have some Epicureans in here, we should start catering some of the breaks, it seems. But I was really interested, someplace over here, I think, said, to discover what I want to do. That's a really, really good use of this class. because there are so many different directions you can go. Let me show you a few examples of that. You might discover you have an interest in knowledge management, maybe something you've never really thought of before, or database design, when we do the database assignment. Many of you thought you were interested in web design. There's a course I didn't list here, should have, in information architecture that would be good for that. So there are lots of different directions you could go. But the most important direction that you might discover is none of the above. You might discover that you thought you didn't really want to do this, but you had to, and you really don't want to do this. And you don't ever want to do it again in the rest of your life. And that's fine. You wouldn't have known that without putting the tone. Right? So I want you to reach your goals, and if your goal is to learn whether you want to do more of this and the answer is no, that's fine. Right? But I want you to engage in that question. I want you to explore, see whether there are parts of this that you find interesting, and use this as a kind of a shopping list to where do you want to go deeper. Right? Because in every program here, in archives, which many of you are in school library media, any of the specialized library science, academic libraries, public libraries, there's room in your schedule to do more of this, or there's room in your schedule to do more of something else, and there's not enough room in anybody's schedule to do everything. So choosing what not to do is just as important as choosing what to do. And I really hope you'll use this opportunity to do that, and, you know, come talk to me between classes or on breaks or something like that about different directions that you think you might be interested in. I'll be more than happy to chat with you about it. It's not just your advisors for those sorts of things. I was struck by the number of people who said that they were interested in learning to build better web pages. That suggests that you'll want to recognize who the other people with common interests are and start to talk with them about what kind of projects you might want to do. Because the project that you will do will need to be real. It'll need to have an actual problem that you're solving. And if you have several people who have interests in this, you'll have several good ideas. You might ultimately decide this isn't the right group of people to work with because everybody wants to go in different directions. So form groups very early, and be willing to break them up if it turns out you formed the group with too many strong personalities that all wanted to do different things. I'm serious about this. So the best way to form groups, you're going to think this is silly, is don't sit in the same chair twice. For the first 5 weeks of the semester, sit in a different chair every time you walk in this room. If everybody does that, y'all are already agreeing.
We like sitting in the same spot.
If everybody does that, you are sure to meet new people each time you come to class and have the chance to chat with them about what their interests are. Okay. You will learn from me much less than half of what you will learn in the class. You will learn from the book much less than half of what you're learning. You will learn from the project maybe half of what you will learn in the class. The class is about experiential learning and about building the base to be able to do that experiential learning. So we start with homework that is well-structured, and then we move towards a less well-structured problem. When teams form, they very often form with people who have like interests, like skills. So for example, you get three program managers on one team and no program managers on another team. Therefore, one team can't decide what to do because there are three people in charge. And there's nobody in charge of the other team, and they can't decide what to do either. Every team needs somebody who gets up in the morning and says, this is what we ought to do. And a bunch of people who say, boy, I'm glad somebody figured out what we're doing. And so you need that skill. every team needs design inspiration. But, you know, people who are good at design often are not detailed people. They look at something and they say, oh, I can imagine something so much better than that. And the detailed person's like, oh, pretty hard, right? And so designers and detailed people, sort of, those are two sides of your brain that may not be together in the same mind, but that's okay, because you'll all have teams of three people. Now, I'm often asked this question about teams. Could my three-person team have two people on it? No. Could my three-person team have four people on it? No, it's a three-person team. So all the teams will be three-person teams. So the trick is to try out, audition many more people than you'll actually want to work with, and then congeal into teams as you get closer around that. So you'll have a process for doing that. But you need to start by thinking that one of the key resources in graduate school, not just in this class, but in graduate school, are the other people in the world. You will learn quite a lot from each other. And that's why it was worth the class time to tell each other one interesting thing about you, something about your life, something about your goals, something about what you're trying to do. So that you can start to make more connections. Okay. Let's see. So these are in the slide. You can just refer to them if you don't have them available to you anyplace else by downloading the slides. In time, we typically talk about seconds, milliseconds, microseconds, nanoseconds, picoseconds, and if you can get to leave numbers. And all we're doing is dividing by 1,000 every time. So is it clear what this notation means? The one to watch out for that's funny, so nanoseconds are sort of, you know, the CPU runs at this speed. Milliseconds, the disk runs at this speed. Seconds, the human runs at this speed. So the machine really is slower than the human. Microseconds are the ones you don't see very much. Very old computers used to run at this speed. So they kind of got the Greek letter, and then after they used it up. Because otherwise they'd have the same two milliseconds and microseconds. So there's some confusion sometimes people have when they try to write these. And that's why people get the people forget about this, and they think there's 1,000 between here and there, a million between here and there. This is a funny one we haven't talked about. If 1,000 things happen every second, how long does each one take? 1,000th of a second, right? So, a millisecond. If it takes me a millisecond to do one thing, how many of them can I do in a second? 1,000, right? Okay. So, kilo, 1,000, milli, 1,000, sort of go together. Megahertz, microseconds. So Hertz is just the name of a guy, right? It's not the guy that started the car company. But all it means is things per second. Actually technically means cycles per second. Think of it as operations per second. So you'll often see the speed of your processor in gigahertz. Right, so if my processor is in gigahertz, then it's billions of things per second. Right, whereas megahertz is millions of things per second. Questions on that? Make sense? This will be useful in the homework, because what will happen is the homework has got a problem that's, you know, something like this. I've got a 3 gigahertz core 2 duo, which runs at 6 million instructions per second, so this is like megahertz. So that's 3 operations per processor every nanosecond. And so if you can flip between these in your head, as you've been seeing, I don't really care if you're up by a factor of 2. But it kind of bothers me when, you know, the answer is a billion and you say 1,000. Right? So if you see what I'm after here, I'm after understanding the issues and the numbers get in the way of the issues. So it's good to have these conversion tables and just write it out. You know, so if it says kilo, just write out 1,000. And then in the kilobytes, that's the case where we have the 1024s and 1024s, stuff like that. But for all I care, you can just round them off and treat them like 1,000. You'll get a number that's real close. You'll never miss the difference in reality. Okay? So we talked about this already. We talked about the cache. The cache is fast. Sometimes we didn't talk about the cache, it has to be low power. If we use the ordinary way of making RAM, what happens is we have to read it and write to it. Because RAM can only remember, dynamic RAM can only remember for a short period of time. Remember what the computer thinks is a short period of time, it's a really short period of time. So what you have to do is you have to every once in a while just go read what's there and write it back, then it kind of decays. You read what's there, write it back, and it decays. So you have to read it and write it, and that act takes power. And so RAM runs pretty hot. But the CPU, which is trying to do things really fast, it's already running really hot. So what we need is we need really cool memory to put on the same chip. I mean, not cool as in really cool, but cool as in not high temperature. So we need memory that'll run cool. And that memory that'll run cool is memory that doesn't have to be written back to all the time. It's memory that will hold things for a long time. And that's called static RAM. And that takes more transistors, which is why you can't get so much of it on a chip. So I can get a lot more into dynamic RAM than I can get into static RAM. So the static RAM is physically larger, but uses lower power, so I can put it on the same chip, and it's really fast. The dynamic RAM is slower, and it's more power hungry, and that's the 6 nanoseconds. So that's what's reached over this really fastest bus in the computer called the front side bus. So this is inside the chip. Once I go outside the chip, everything gets slower because the speed of light things are further away. And then there's another kind of static memory that I could write to slowly, but then I can read from quickly. And it will stay there forever. It's sort of like really, really static. And for a strange reason, it's called read-only memory. Because there is read-only memory inside your computer. It's what the computer uses to boot up. It has to run a program when you first turn it on. So it's literally just hardwired. They just burn it. And so then they came along and said, well, hey, we could make something that's electronically burnable. So it's electronically programmable read-only memory. And then they said, hey, we could make it erasable. And it's not read-only, right? In fact, it wasn't read-only as soon as we could write to it. Now, there's been some talk within the intelligence community about making write-only memory that nobody can ever read, but nobody has ever figured out a good use for it. So in any case, this isn't really read-only memory because you can write to it and you can erase it. And so after a while, it's really easy to say ROM and RAM. But try saying this. People say EEPROM, right? So anyway, it's really hard to sell EEPROMs to people. So somebody figured out that if you called it flash memory, everybody would buy it. Right, so that's what the memory sticks that you can get, or the SD chips that you put into your digital cameras, that's what those are. And it's hard to make them large enough to compete with hard drives. So for example, I told you get a 1 terabyte hard drive. This thing has got a 2 gigabyte SD card in it, micro SD card. So how much bigger is a terabyte than 2 gigabytes? 500 times, right? See how this goes? So there's a limit to how big this gets, but normally this is fairly small, this is fairly small, this is getting larger, this is pretty large. Right? And then if you keep going, you get to rotating memory. There are two kinds of rotating memory. There's the magnetic disk. Fixed here doesn't mean that it doesn't rotate. It rotates, but it's not removable. Or there's the removable magnetic disk. So it used to be that floppy disks were common, which was really strange because floppy disks, like, you can't bend them, they break. The old ones you could bend, right? They had cardboard around them.
Floppy.
Yeah, they're really floppy, but the new ones, the actual disc inside is floppy, but the case is not, so it's sort of a weird name. Anyway, those are sort of falling out of fashion as the flash drives get cheaper. And then there were some other technologies people had for higher density than that. But what's much more common is a removable optical disc, the either DVD or CD. There's a question for you. Let's say I'm an archivist, and I get some data, and it's on a floppy disk. What do I do?
Convert it to more current technology.
I convert it to some more current technology. What would I pick?
Probably
the DVD. So how long does DVD last?
Well, 5 to 7 years, I think, is over.
I'm sorry?
It's like 5 to 7 years or something like that. So you put it on a couple things. You put it on DVD, and then you put it on like online storage, and you print out a copy of stuff.
What's online storage? Online storage is just another disk, right?
It's like a server.
Yeah, but there's some disk way out there, right?
Yeah, so you'd also print out some disk.
Yeah, okay. So in the end, what we do is we put the thing on microfilm. Did you see that the thing in the book about we'll put it on microfilm?
Yes.
So, yeah, that's great, but how do I get it back in? Right? Can you microfilm into this thing? Yeah, the book has something silly about the preservation microfilm having direct writers from that. It's like, that's okay. It's the ultimate backup, but there's no way to read the digital data back in. You'll end up OCRing the microfilm. We actually do that. We do some OCR of preservation microfilm because somebody preserves something, well, you know, optically, and then later we want to make an access copy. So this is a real problem with all these media for two reasons. One is we don't know how long DVDs last. I mean, we haven't had DVDs very long. How would we know how long DVDs last? So what do people do? They put them in an oven and bake them. They stomp on them and they say, you know, that's like, well, okay, but that's just sort of simulating bad things that might happen. You know, they blow the Sahara across it. So we don't really know how long a DVD lasts. But we sure as heck know when it's gone, right? And it's a big disaster when it is. So we wouldn't want to use a technology like DVD for preservation. We understand tape real well. The problem with tape is that I put the first bit at the beginning of the tape, and then the second bit I put it second on the tape, and the third bit I put it third on the tape, and if I ever want it back off, I have to play the whole tape to get to the bit I want. But that's okay if all I'm trying to do is preserve it. Right? So it's really bad for access. But it's fairly high density for preservation. The problem is that I keep this tape wrapped up, and then when I bake it, that's not the best, right? So there's a question about what do I do for media selection, and having multiple approaches is very good for high value data. But I also have high volume problems, like the Internet Archive. Snapshots the entire internet, stores it, and then goes out a few weeks later and snapshots the entire internet and stores it, duplicates and all. And then goes out a few weeks later and snapshots it. So this is not really high value data. If I lost, you know, 2 weeks worth of internet, it wouldn't be the end of the world. But on the other hand, it's very high volume data. So I may need a different preservation strategy for high volume data, where I'm willing to take a risk on losing some part of it, the long dimension data. Okay, so things to think about, which we'll go back across later in the semester. We talked about Moore's Law. Moore's Law applies to lots of things. But Moore really only figured out one thing. He was looking at a picture that looked like this. It was way back here. They had some chips that were getting faster, and they noticed that every year it was getting faster by some relative amount. So notice what's going on here. This is in powers of 10 that are going up, right? And what Moore figured out, that the key to the entire operation is that an integrated circuit is essentially one flat piece of sand, one flat piece of silver. And if I can make the circuit bigger, right, if I can make the chip physically larger, there are mechanical problems with doing this, right, being able to plug it in, not having it break. But if I can do that, then If I make it twice as big this way, the chip becomes four times as large. Twice as big this way, twice as big that way, right? Right? So if I can get a linear increase of a power of 2, I get a power of 4 improvement. I don't have to get much increase in size before I start to pick up a large increase in the number of transistors I can get on this chip. The same thing works in the other direction. If I can etch the transistors closer together, a small decrease in the feature size gives me a substantial increase in the number of transistors I can get on. This entire game has been played based on bringing the transistors closer and closer together. Now, how long can that go on? Okay. They might, except that nanotechnology is operating on the scale of atoms. And so now we're all of a sudden going to have parts of atoms. And it's going to be very hard to think about how to do that. So it seems like the physics that we know will break down at some point. And so you can actually run this out and figure out at what point this levels off for any given level of technology. Now, it may turn out that etching things on sand is the wrong idea. We should be using light waves that interfere with each other in a clever way. So there are people working on optical computing for that reason. But for silicon-based computing, this ends. Sooner or later, because you get down to the size of atoms. Now think about what happens when that happens to us. We have an entire economy that since the 1960s has been based on a graph that goes in that direction. At which point the graph starts going in this direction. What this says is, whatever the balance is between people time and machine time, in the future, people time will be relatively more expensive and machine time will be relatively cheaper. Yeah, that's what that graph says. And at some point, that will stabilize. There's nothing that says it will reverse, but it will become stable. What consequences will that have for what looked like a good career to go into, what the structure of the industry is that provides these products? One more thing, just for fun. This was mentioned in the book sort of in, if you want to know about this, go look at the website. Disks have moving parts and moving parts break. So when I'm running one of these online servers, how do I guard against the disk break? Keep the Sahara out of my disk room.
Redundancy.
I'll simply copy it here and somewhere else. So the Internet Archive did this. They took the entire Internet Archive and they put it directly on top of the San Andreas Fault. Literally, that's where it is. It's in San Francisco, in the old Presidio of San Francisco, directly on top of the San Andreas Fault. So they wanted to find a place that would give them the sort of most decoupled threats. Whatever was a threat to the San Andreas Fault would be not a threat to them in this new place. So where did they go? Alexandria, Egypt. Think of a harder place to put a server farm than Alexandria. But whatever threats you have in Alexandria are quite unlikely to affect whatever's going on in Silicon Valley and vice versa. Right? And now they want to put a third one in China. Right? With the idea of decoupling these things politically, because they're trying to keep them over generations. Right? If you talk to the archivist of the United States and you ask him, what is your mission? He says, to keep the records of the American society until the end of the Republic. And you're like, well, okay, great. What about after that? We care about a lot of things that were from the Republic's defense, right? Not his problem. But it is the problem in the Internet Archive, where they're trying to figure out how to keep things in very long time. Okay, so so redundancy is one way to do it. The problem is, that kind of redundancy doubles my cost. A little more than double, because I have to move the data around. So how could I get redundancy without doubling my cost? This is just a massively good trick. Here's what I'm going to do. Let's say that I originally had a bunch of disks, and I could put one bit on every disk. It's not really how it works, but it's pretty close. So I put one bit on every disk. I've got 8 bits. I can get 256 possible values, right? Yes? Okay, here's the game I'm going to play. I go out and buy a few more disks. Now notice I did not double my number of disks. Right? I just got a few more disks. Now I can keep 4,096 possible values. But I'm only going to store 256 possible values. So I can write those 256 possible values a lot of different ways. Right? I can have a lot of different valid ways of writing 256 possibilities when I have 4,096 to choose from. With me so far? So now I'll set them up so that any one bit error leads me closer to one of them, to one valid way, than to another. So I take the 256, I spread them around the 4,096 possibilities so that any bit you flip makes it really obvious which bit must have been flipped. There's one bit I can flip back that will get me to a valid code, and there's no other single bit flip that would get me to a valid code. And you can do this with 4,096 out of 256. So if you take if you have eight disk drives, you add 4 more, you can have any one disk fail. And I mean, literally, you can just reach in and pull the disk out of the system. And the system will continue to produce the same data. You can pop another disk in, and the system will write the proper data back to that disk. It'll reconstruct what was on that disk. And then, if another disk fails, pull that one out and replace it. Now, if two disks fail at the same time, you better hope you didn't need that copy of the internet. But you're guaranteed against a single disk failure for about a 30% increase in the number of disks you have to buy. If you want to be protected against two disk failures, it's of course possible. Because remember, you could have just copied it to 5 different places, right? So it's certainly possible to protect against any number of disk failures. In fact, there is something called LOCKS, lots of copies keep stuff safe, that simply copies journal articles to every other participating LOCKS site. There aren't that many journal articles. They're not that big. You put that on the homework. And so the storage cost of storing it is small. The cost of losing something permanently is high, so you just copy everything everything. So, but you can get RAID 5 is the technique that's used to do this. It stands for reliable aggregation with inexpensive disks or something like that. And these days you get RAID controllers in your PC when you buy one from the store. If it comes with two disk drives, so the RAID controller doesn't control the RAID 5 is the one that does this. Watch out, there's a RAID 0 that simply copies the first thing to the first disk, the second thing to the second disk, so it can transfer faster in parallel, but there's no redundancy at all. So the redundant use of RAID is in RAID 5 for single failures, or RAID 6 for double failures. Does this part make sense? No. Ask a question that will make it make sense.
It's inside
my PC, I've got a hard drive. My hard drive might fail. I don't really care because I can replace it for my backup, right? If my hard drive fails and I've been backing up my hard drive, I'm okay. I'll just replace it, right? But what if I'm running a server array? What if I want high availability? What if I can't afford to be offline? Well, then I can keep multiple copies of everything and just throw a switch if one of them breaks. but then I have to pay factor of two for factor of two redundancy, or factor of three for triple redundancy. But with clever coding, I can get it for, I can get one single failure redundancy for about 30% more disks. So if I had an array of 10 disks, I just need an array of 13 disks.
That's not in your PC, right?
No, it's in my server farm.
Oh, okay.
If I'm running a server farm. So it's the step beyond. But PCs come with these controllers. So you could configure, if you bought a lot of disks for your PC, you could configure it to do at least RAID 1. Okay, you all look like you need a break. You're sitting here going, you could say we're doing time. So, 5 minutes? Calisthenics outside? All eight? What's that? There you go.
Something to start with.
I know, but I'm thinking, oh,
you know. Yeah, you gotta try something to start with. It's cheap, and
I know.
We'll see if it's good. If it's good, that's all that matters,
that's
right?
True. That's true. I would rather
do something. Yeah, but you see, I don't really care about how I do it as long as it tastes good. So, and it's still lots of time. So, anyway, one of them is like. Oh, well, yeah, if I could do that, I would. I don't have the money in this time. I guess I was not, when I was looking at stuff, I was not seeing anything. But it's still, it's fun, so.
So what are you working on?
And then the other one is, it's not done yet. I wish I did. I should go for it.
Okay, so we forgot to introduce one person who's going to be very important for us, and that's Andy. Andy, can you come join us? So this is Andy. You want to say a couple of words about your background and goals and all that other stuff we did? Why are you here?
I worked at the same class last semester. Like you said, I'm Andy. I work for OIT Student Tech Classroom Support. I'm an undergraduate student as well.
So Andy's goal is to study while we're in class, and if you need help with your machine, then what works really well is if you say, "Hey, Andy," in a loud voice, and Andy will pop over and get your machine working for you, or get whatever you get help transferring stuff. At the end of class, we're going to take the video and transfer it off to the web page. So I'll work with Andy on that. And if you've got stuff you need to transfer off, you can point you in the right direction around it and start with it. Okay, good. Thanks. Okay, so what I wanted to do here at the end, as promised, is to do what you would normally expect to do at the beginning, which is talk about what this class is about. So, this is on the website. I really want you to come away from this class with an understanding of what computers can't do and what they can do, right? It's not good enough to just come away with an understanding of what we know how to do today. I want to come away with an understanding of fundamentally what are these things capable of. Because over the course of your career, what we figure out specifically how to do with them is going to change. So I'm not nearly as interested in your learning Excel or Word or PowerPoint or Access or any of those things. I mean, great, you'll learn some of those things, it'll be useful to you in your time here, it'll be helpful that everybody has the same background, but gosh, what you think of as the web today is nothing like what the web was like 10 years ago, right? Which is nothing like what the web's going to be like 10 years from now. We're in the midst of profound change. So trying to learn where we are right now, nail the jello to the floor, doesn't make nearly as much sense as trying to understand what's fundamental about this. Which is why we've been doing the class the way we've been doing it. Right? I mean, the blink of an eye and a nanosecond aren't going to change their relationship in your lifetime. Right? Your eye will still blink at about the same speed, and the nanosecond might become a picosecond, but you'll have the idea. And the fact that the hard drive is operating like in a different universe, a million times slower, it's mechanical. That's not going to change. As long as there are mechanical things, it's going to be way slower, which is why eventually solid-state memories will replace hard drives. But then you'll still have the DVD that's operating a million times slower, right? The same, all the mechanical things will operate more slowly. Okay, so those are the goals. How do we do it? Well, I really don't believe I could teach you this. You have to learn it. And you have to learn it by engaging with the ideas. Now, some people are better at getting ideas from books. Some people are better at getting ideas from conversations. Some people are better at getting ideas hands-on. And some people are better at getting ideas the night before the exam. So, we have techniques to help all of you. And you don't have to be good at getting ideas in all of these ways. You just have to be good at getting ideas in many of these ways. So try to engage with all of them and see which work for you. You learn different things. Experiential learning is very narrow and focused. the book is just incredibly broad. It's just, I mean, it's everything all at once, equal level of detail. The class is like conceptual La La Land, right? Except that it reaches down and connects to specific things and pulls them up and weaves them together. And in the class, you get to actively engage in a way that's different from the way you engage with the book. But on the other hand, in the class, it's very hard to stop it. Because in the book, you can engage at your own pace. So use them all. Use them for what they're good for. Many people find that it's good to read the book before you come to class, then come to class, then go back and read specific things in the book afterwards. I had one student who discovered that the previous semester's videos were on the web, and so after every class would watch the previous semester's video to see the same ideas expressed in a different way, to see what was common to the two presentations. That's probably the important part. Every semester, I watch the videos once from the previous semester, and I get to the point where I say, I should have told them this. And then I do. Every time. Okay. So here's the fun. We're going to start out talking about computers, which we're done now. So you'll have a homework due next week at 5:30. So there's no incentive to skip class. And then we'll do networking. And then you'll have a homework on that, and we'll do HTML. Then we'll do multimedia. And then, after the end from the right, comes the first quiz, which is counts for the same amount as the homework, and the homeworks are, you know, two of them are throwaway, and the rest counts for 3 points each. And you earn the points by making a good try. So what the quiz is really about is about reducing the tension when you get to the midterm exam. So it's just to see what an example is like. It's just the first few minutes of class. And then we go on, finish the first half of the semester with programming and databases. And then I have databases here, which are highlighted in a dotted way to indicate they're not on the midterm. So the midterm occurs the next week, and then you begin your project. During this time, you've been reading two readings a week. After that, you switch to one reading a week and focus a lot of energy on your project. And meanwhile, we do these things. Now, it'll become clear what these things are as we go through, but what these things are is, web is a way of looking at all these things. Human-computer interaction is a way of looking at all these things. So you can think of this as the perpendicular slice. So, look, if I said something about RAID arrays and you didn't understand it today, well, maybe when we come back across search or when we come back across system life cycles, we'll cross that idea again and it'll make sense in context. You have to know the answer to understand the question. And so we see everything twice in the semester. Once in an engineer way of thinking, and then once in a sort of a humanist way of thinking. You know. What are we really trying to do here? What do we have at our disposal to do with it? And then you get a final exam. I shouldn't have picked references. But they served focus. Biggest problem people have is getting behind. If you didn't have the book, didn't have a chance to read in advance, then this is a real good time to catch up because two readings a week, a homework every week, class every week, the rest of your life every week, we're running on a train schedule. If you miss a week, it's gone. There's no way to get it back. So don't get behind. Do what you did today. Pick something in the reading you want to understand better, and let's talk about it. Literally, we don't need in the class to go through any particular point. We may as well hang the ideas, hang the discussion on the points that you found most interesting. I'll bring a discussion as well each week, as you've seen. But as you've seen, we didn't go through the slides. So it's really hard to use a slide that way, but it's really nice to look back at it and say, do I understand this? Do I understand that? Does this make sense? No? Time to ask the question about this. You shouldn't think that you can possibly learn all the technical details that you'll need to know in the course of your career here in one semester. But the ones that you need to know to do the project, or the ones that you personally want to learn about, you can pick up from books, from web resources, from tutorials, or you can come see the TA or me, and we can go through with you the specific skills you need to pick up to allow you to do what you want. So use outside resources, don't count on just the things inside the class. And pick what you want to learn more about and go deep there. Okay. This is my favorite graphic in the entire class. We have to get from the lower left to the upper right. How would you expect to get there? Any rational person would expect to do this. But that's not what I did in graduate school. That's what I did in graduate school. Right? So you kind of go along, and then you get kind of close to the end of the semester, and then you do it. This is what we do in this class. So you become experts in climbing cliffs. You just find what's a computer cliff. That's an entire bachelor's degree in computer science. Now we're going to do the networking cliff, right? And it's just, it's one cliff after another. Most common complaint that I get in this class, by the way, you can go to student services and you can get the teaching evaluations, and there's still time to change to the Tuesday section. Most common complaint that I get is that the class got too easy after the midterm. It didn't feel like a good use of time. Because you see what happened, right? People got very good at climbing the cliff. And then they're still going like this. And the class requirements are going like that. And it seems like it's an awfully easy class. So I kind of like getting comments. Okay, so this is the idea we talked about. We'll master the tools in the first 7 weeks, and then we'll explore integrating issues in the last 7 weeks in bite-sized chunks while you're doing some other chunk for your project. The grading is like horribly complex. There's more numbers up here on those today. It's really very simple in its idea. So for the exam, you get 25% for your best exam. That's either the midterm or the final. And you get 10% for the other one. Right? So if you do really well on your midterm, you can skate the final. I mean, you can't lose very much. If you don't do so well on the midterm, the final can pull you out, and it'll make the midterm count for less. Right? So you don't have to do well on every exam you take. You just have to do well on some exams you take. And so, thank you. I really want you to work in groups for the homework. I mean, I don't care what groups. Groups across class sections, groups within the class, groups with your friends, you know, people you know. People can tell you the answer to the homework. It's fine with me. The only requirement I have is your fingers on the keyboard when you type it in. Because I figure if it moves from your eye through your brain to the fingers, something was sick, right? So it's a learning experience. You get 3% of your grade for every homework that doesn't get thrown out. The bottom two get thrown out. Now, either homeworks or quizzes can get thrown out. That's why it's both 15% or about 38%. 40% of the grade is group work. For most people, this is great. Except for the one group in every class that is the group of people who couldn't find a group. That's what makes them a group. And they then will fight with each other over everything. Don't do that. Right? Work hard at finding a group. And if you need my help, come see me. I'll help put groups together. Right? We can do speed dating. I actually did that in one of my classes. Okay. And 10% for class participation. Now, what does that do? Well, first, I should be clear. I don't care if you come to class. So I'm not taking attendance. What I'm looking for is, at the end of the semester, an understanding of the way in which you have contributed to the class. You can contribute to the class with questions. You can contribute to the class by sending things that you found to the mailing list. Everybody can post to the mailing list, so interesting resources. You can contribute to the class by answering the questions I asked in class. We can attribute success in lots of different ways. Find your own way. I'm not looking for, you know, attributed to 8 out of 10 classes, 80%. No. I'm looking for profound ways to make meaningful contributions to the class. So what do I mean by you don't have to come to class? Well, literally, you don't have to come to class. Watch the entire thing on TV if you want to and be done with it. But I think you'll miss then some opportunity to engage with the audience. So it's your choice.
And I realize everybody's schedule is nuts. And that you know, there'll be some time when you just won't be able to make it. Everybody else can. We'll have a class. We'll do it. Okay. So here's some things to remember. This one shocked me. Yeah, I got this funny grading scheme where, you know, if you've been to well on the midterm, you do well on the final. But it turns out that the people that don't do well on the midterm don't do well on the final either. Right? So, really comes down to finding ways to engage with the material. Do that early. That's why I added the quiz. But I added the quiz to help you develop ways of engaging with the material, ways of engaging with these kinds of questions. The homework's there to help you do that. The quiz is there to help you do that. And then the midterm's there to help you do that. It's not a perfect correlation. And finally, don't forget that one exam is worth more than all the homework put together, final long shot. So don't obsess over the homework grade measuring. Homework grade doesn't measure very much. It measures things. Typically, people almost everybody gets hundreds on grade because people don't know. And finally, you don't need to be good at everything. I've actually worked this out. You track individuals through the class, and you can be good at several things and get a very good grade in the class. It is possible to get a poor grade in the class. It happens in about one out of every two semesters that somebody gets a grade of C plus. But there are plenty of semesters where nobody does. So it's not necessary if you're after an A to be sterling at everything. If you're sterling at everything, you get an A plus. But you can just be good at many things. As I said, group work is allowed,
except on these things.
Please don't group work on these exams. And there's no sense of humor at all on the deadline. 5:30, not 5:31 for the homework. You can send it early, and you can replace it if you want to, but you can't send it at 5:31. Because I want you to class at 5:31. I want you thinking about stuff. Okay, on the other hand, we drop the rules too, so if you trip once, group once. Okay, if you save your files on your, if you've written anything on your computer, you can just save it. You've got an M drive, which has got your user ID name on it. You can save it there, go home, go to this URL on Windows Explorer, and you can just drag and drop the file. It'll ask you to log in. You can drag and drop the file. If you save it on the C drive, it won't be there when you get back, and there's no way to ever get it. So if you really want to find out if you've got it done right, stick it on the M drive, bring up Internet Explorer, and go see what it looks like to find it. Or if you have a thumb drive, you can pop it on the thumb drive, or we can teach you what we're going to teach you anyway next week, which is FTP. And you can use FTP to move it to a land or something.
Question about that, because when she logged me and I think a number of other people, she didn't log this in under our name. She logged it in under a master account of some sort, so really you won't be able to pick yours up if you're logged in under someone else.
That's right. If you're not logged in on your own account, you should use FTP or a phone.
Chip, should the assignments be sent to Rebecca or you, both, or?
They should be sent to Rebecca. What you're going to actually send after the second assignment, I think, is a URL for a web page, and then hang everything off the web page. So there's, you know, it's not like it can get lost easily. But for the first one, you're entirely dependent on email. If you'd like to CC me as an insurance policy, then you know my email will be your insurance policy. Other questions?
Oh,
Okay, I'd like you to do one thing for me before you get.
There's no list of everybody in the class with their email addresses. I know there's a link you may, not a link, an email address to send if we want to send it to everybody. So is there anywhere we can get, like when we're on Elms, I can send an individual email to somebody.
Does anybody object to my sending email addresses to everybody? Okay, I'll send you the entire list of email addresses without the mappings to names, perhaps. I know I can do that, just dump the who's on the mailing list, and you can get most of the associations. So I think I can send the two column list. And I'll do that by Wednesday afternoon, so if it hasn't occurred by Wednesday afternoon, would you do what two of you did on Sunday and say, hey, Thomas, send something to the list on Friday. Right? Okay. Good. Okay, so I need your help. If you would please pull out a piece of paper. Yes, I know, this is very bad. If you don't have paper, find a friend who has paper. Now, I actually want the paper when you're done. And we just answer that question. And just stack them up here on your way out. Then what I'll do is I will read them before the next class, and if there is no better way of linking 2 weeks than to have me begin with what is presently fuzzy in your mind. So just a line that, you know, that'll call to mind, you know, 2 thirds of you are going to write great, I know it. What I do with these is I sort them in the stacks, and the biggest stack I talk about first. When we come into class. So if you write 5 things, I'll simply sort it into the biggest stack because you'll have written everything everybody else wrote. So just 1 thing.
Please
log off. Nobody else needs USB?